The following episode of Fathermore Podcast features Oliver Bateman as my guest, and you probably don't know Oliver, but you probably do know his work because he's a very prolific writer. He's written hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words. He's got bylines in The Ringer and Washington Examiner and just all these different publications online and print, and just he's all over the place. And that is his side gig. He actually works full-time in marketing as well, and he's one half of the What's Left podcast. So he's got a lot of irons in the fire, if you would consider that as a good metaphor. And he's got a really interesting story about how he grew up and his relationship with his dad and the lessons that he learned from his dad, both good and bad, and how he's applying it to his daughter, his 20-month-old daughter, Cleo Rose. And it really is a great conversation because I've only known Oliver through Twitter. And so getting a chance to actually talk to him over Zoom and getting a chance to get to know him a little bit better and hear these stories from him was really, really fascinating. And it was a very fun conversation, very interesting conversation. And I think Oliver's a really interesting guy. And again, chances are you've read some of the stuff that he's written. You've probably actually listened to some of the takes that he's got. And I think that he's a very fun follow on Twitter because he absolutely does the work. And we spent a great deal of time here talking about the work of being a dad. And I think you guys are going to enjoy the conversation just as much as I did. Take care.
I do like a little intro thing after it's all.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Yeah. Your audio is really clean.
Yeah, got the Blue Yeti mic here. I'm not messing around.
Oh yeah, serious business. USB?
It is USB. Hey, I'm still lazy, but it does the job.
I think I used to have. I think in this closet behind my camera, I actually have one.
Next level up, I'll go to the next setup because I mean, my podcast co-host has a much better Shure mounted mic.
Yeah.
So that'll be the next upgrade I make. I just can't commit to that right now. I'm just like, oh my god.
I got this thing.
As long as this is doing the job and it sounds good on your end, then.
Yeah. Yeah. You sound fine. You sound totally fine. I mean, it's like, I got this thing like, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. I've been using this exact mic or model of mic for like 12 years in my podcasts. And I just did a podcast with a friend of mine who's like, you got to upgrade that thing. That thing's old. I was like, it works. I don't know
There's a limit. There's diminishing returns on audio for podcasts, especially if they're listening for content. You know, if it's like audio less, the Radio Lab or something, then that's different.
Yeah. And I'm not doing ASMR here. I'm not just.
It's gotta be perfect to that.
Yeah. The $10,000 vocal mics and the $1,000 cables and that.
Yeah, I'm not doing multi-instrument recording either. Like, this does great for work and for podcasting and sounds clear and clean.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome.
Not beautiful, but close. Good.
It, you know what it is? It brings out the dulcet tones of Oliver Bateman. That's what it does.
That's all I need.
That the voice, again, another thing is like, I think I've heard one episode of What's Left before you guys locked it, right? When you guys first started it
was that was my Kita.
So
I remember listening to
an episode and I couldn't put a picture to the voice. I couldn't put a face to the voice. I couldn't put a voice to the face. Like it just wasn't clicking for some reason. So you know, there definitely was, I mean, between you and Amy, I couldn't tell which one of you had which voice, you know.
There
was a third person, wasn't there?
There are guests all the time. Angela Nagel was a recurring guest for a while, and there's some other people that come back frequently. Like now Glenn Greenwald is on the show.
Cool.
Sometimes. So like and his voice is very distinctive relative to mine. So
yes it is.
It's a different thing. It's hard to Zoom video helps. I'm always on video when I'm recording anyway, because I'm like, yeah, you know, I think that helps you see when I'm talking. We don't talk over each other. Amy talks over everybody, so it doesn't matter. That's the
tragedy of podcasts is that you get a lot of times people just talking over each other, and it makes an unlistenable experience.
The more they're friends with me in real life or her, the more overtalk there is. Just like in work meetings.
You just expect people to talk over you, or you just let it happen? Come on.
Oh, I got to run a tight ship now, but it does happen. It can get pretty rough. I like to just go back and forth, but some people like to overtalk.
I don't know. I actually don't know. I took some notes. I've been going through your Twitter. I've been trying to find, like, I was trying to find first what would have possibly introduced me to you. No clue.
It's got to be a story involving either Bell or Roberts. They were in a bunch of things.
It's got to be, right?
In 2015, yes. 2016, which around is when then. I had maybe like 1,000 followers.
Yes. Yes. And now you're crushing it. You're approaching like 10,000 followers on Twitter.
Oh, which, and I'm really locked. I locked it down so my boss at work can't see that I'm tweeting during the workday when she has stuff due.
Okay. So I really want to get into this. I love this because you are a violently prolific tweeter. I mean, like, you are just thread after thread after thread, and you have a day job and you write for, like, I don't know, 600 different publications, and you have a podcast, and like everybody else on the face of the planet, you exist. So therefore there are certain needs that must be met during the day for you to continue existing.
Right.
And you've got a little girl, the milk. Yeah. I've seen, again, another thing that you tweet about is the photos of your milk collection, your milk jugs.
Drink a lot of milk.
Is that goat milk or is that cow milk?
That is cow milk from the farm.
Nice.
It's in a mason jar.
And yes.
I put down a bunch of those, two of those a day.
So how do you possibly have any time? How do you possibly have any time to, like, just be Oliver Bateman? Or is this what it is?
This is it. Content. I'm a content man. And I'm a content man, Armin, and nobody knows how they know me.
So I'm like, just content
man who's just around. No, a content man who's just around. Like, it's because I've covered all these topics. Not even all these topics. I cover like 5 topics, but that covers a wide stretch of ground. So you meet a lot of different people in the course of that. But yeah, I'm generating content. Like, in my day job is generating content. Like, I work in marketing and I'm a content writer.
Wow.
So it's all content all the time.
It's just pumping out words.
Yeah. Yeah. And some are better than others. You know, sometimes you write a piece and it just comes off and you're like, that's good. And sometimes you write something and it's 400 or 500 words for work and it's absolute shit. And you have no idea. You just got to force it through, you know?
Yeah. And in the middle of all of this, in the middle of being just a content tornado, a stampede of content, you have a little girl.
I do. Yes. Yes.
A little girl that
is old.
20 months old. Okay. So my son goes 3 months in a couple of days. So we're right in the middle.
That's like a puddle age. They're like a puddle at that age.
Yeah. You can still leave them somewhere. I could still, like, put him down and walk away and not be surprised by coming back and seeing him in the same place.
Hard to believe that was ever a phase, but yes, that's what they do then. They just lay and maybe they look at the ceiling fan or the mobile or whatever. And
yeah,
enjoy that while it lasts. Although they sleep erratically a bit. So it is nice that she sleeps from 7 a.m. to 6 a.m. or 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. It'd be nice if she slept from 7 a.m. to 6. But she sleeps, you know, straight through the night, and she takes a nap during the day. But when she's up, she's up.
And you work from home, I'm assuming.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I'm in the process of finishing the basement. I'm actually in one of the basement offices right now that we're coming along with. My wife and I still have to paint the room. This will probably be her office when she goes back to doing therapy. My larger office, we're in the process of wiring up and laying down some flooring, basic stuff. And then I'm going to be moving out of the office room upstairs. It's going to become a playroom because my daughter, you know, is going to consume the entire first floor. She spilled into the dining room. the living room, the kitchen, and then we'll be taking the office as well. And she has her nursery upstairs.
And she's the only child?
Yeah, it's just one, 5 rooms. And my wife is still like, oh, you know, house isn't big enough. Oh, and we just put a huge new porch on, like with that Trex decking material. So, you know, I could put another house on and it wouldn't be big enough for Cleo Rose, my daughter.
You know, my my wife and I are very adamant that we're gonna try to keep our son from spreading like the plague across our house. Luck. We've already basically not been able to contain it.
When they're out.
There's an urgency. There's an urgency that comes with a toddler, and I'm not sure I'm ready for it.
My wife told me it was coming, and around like 6 months, they're going to start moving. You got to have all the outlets sealed. You got to have everything prepped. You got to have gates up. And sure enough, yeah, they're on the move. And when they're on the move, fortunately, my daughter has had really good balance, you know, so she hasn't had a lot of spills or falls or anything, but also she's had really good balance. So she is now like very likely to try even higher falls and dives and other things because she hasn't had the kind of accidents and spills that other kids have had. But yeah, when they start coming out, and not only do they come out, but their stuff, we have several friends of ours have had kids, one recently. And so we have either loaned out or given away the Cleo stuff already. Cause if you don't, you know, like the contents of all these Chinese factories will spill over into your house. And yeah, you won't, you can't possibly be ready for how much of it will come in. And if you're not getting it, your wife will be getting it. And in my case, you know, like I did a couple product reviews for Fatherly, and that put me on the mailing list for other products that were being sent to me. So like, not only did products we use come in, but products we weren't using or products we might use. We have like 5 strollers, I think. We've been able to get it down through loaning them out to 2. There's like a Tool jogger and a Nuna Pippa, which I did review, or Nuna Triv, or whatever they call the thing. So there's 2, and then there's actually there's a third one down here, but we're gonna divest ourselves of that. We've gotten rid of the other ones. We have a Likey trike. We have every one of these things. We had the Snoo, the bed that swings the baby. I actually reviewed that for Fatherly.
Yeah, what'd you think of it?
It helped, and it's helping the woman that it's currently with too, because it's probably more help for her because she's got kind of he's a bit of a crier, you know, and I think the Snoo is probably soothing him. And I think with Cleo, it helped, but Cleo's problem wasn't crying. It's just when she's up, and when she's down, and you can swing her head a million times, and she's just gonna go. But we did get sleep consultations from Harvey Karp, which was pretty cool, and he basically just gave us the advice that like, yeah, you know, she's just going to develop like she's going to develop, which is what every pediatrician seems to say.
Harvey, is he the guy who invented the Snoo? He's at like,
yeah. Doctor. And then the, like the sleeps, the happiest baby on the block, that system.
Yeah.
I never thought baby. I'd be this up close and personal to all these characters that seem to sell things to other parents, but I mean, it's actually pretty sound advice. I mean, he considers treating the first 3 months like the fourth trimester.
Yeah.
They did extra womb time.
Yeah. They like, I actually went to college with his daughter and I had no idea what she did. I just remember them, you know, they're really well off. They're very wealthy.
There's no doubt of that.
And I was like, you know, she said her daughter is a doctor and that he's written some books. And that was about as far as that conversation went. Right. And I was like, okay, cool. Like, I didn't really pay attention to what she was saying about what her dad did. And so, you know, we hung out for a little bit and then we've stayed friends, like we've stayed in touch. And I remember seeing her post on Instagram. You know, I had no idea what she did for work. And I saw her post on Instagram, like, oh, check out this, like, magazine cover. She was on like Forbes or something. I was like, what? Like, how did this happen? So I just Googled her finally after like 15 years of knowing her. And then it turns out that she's the one who named the Snoo, and she runs the company now.
Started at the top and stayed there.
Correct.
You know?
Correct.
It's a good way to go. Didn't go downhill, you know, started at the top and
it's a good way to go.
But you know, it's a fine product. It's well made. Highly recommend it. They I guess rent it to you if you need it as well. But if you have friends or other babies on the way, you could reuse it or split the cost of it or something. But yeah, they're undoubtedly well. I was in a class with Mac Brown's daughter at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill after that football coach had gone to the University of Texas, and was, you know, we're just sort of like trashing him in some way. And this girl is sitting there and, you know, interjects that that's her father. That's another one of those moments where you're just like, oh yeah, whatever. I mean, everybody's somebody's kid.
Yeah. Like, don't worry, I'm not gonna hold it against you.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah, it's fine. You know, she's used to it apparently. I mean, the trade-offs of being Mac Brown's daughter are probably quite good. He was making several million a year, even.
Yeah, you're doing okay when you're the highest paid government employee as the football coach for, you know, the local state university. Yeah, I think you're doing all right. I think you're doing just fine. You mentioned that you never thought you'd be up close and personal with people who are like schlocking these baby and child things, which, as like a side note, is there any other market in which fear of death is the main
standard?
It's like, there isn't
probably medicine. I mean, you know, probably medicine.
Even medicine isn't really sold. Like, you know, what I felt as a father of a newborn, what I felt was every product was either being marketed to me as this will prevent your child from dying, or if you don't get this, your child will die, which is the more extreme version.
Yeah. And you know, things like SIDS are held out as these great mysteries, even though like pediatricians will like, you know, cough and tell you that as unknowable as it seems, there seems to be some type of causality in a lot of the, you know, there's causation in some of those cases that we just don't want to talk about. You know, rolling on the baby drunk or these sorts of things, or, you know, doing something like being intoxicated, putting the baby some factor, but who knows? I mean, because you are just expecting them to, honestly, like I you're just expecting them to like kick off at any point in the process, you know, and my wife, because, you know, she carried Cleo Rose to term, I think feels those things even more than I do. And, or at least we did. I mean, I think at this stage, maybe we feel like we're out of the woodwork, but Cleo has been sick. We've been tracking it 6 times. Doesn't go to daycare. She's just here, but she's been sick 6 times since she was born. Ear infection, a couple of colds, some other things. So roughly in line with some babies we know that are going to daycare. So I don't know if there's anything you can do, but each infection, like if I had a cold or when I had colds, I'd roll into work, give it to everybody else, you know, just fine. I don't care. Desk doorstep still working, but like baby gets the sniffles and you're like, oh no, poor Cleo Rose.
I don't know what we're going to do the first time. When he gets sweaty, true story. Yesterday I was holding him. We'd just been traveling. We went to go visit my wife's family in Washington State. We live in California. Went to go visit my wife's family in Washington State. We were just traveling with the baby. We come back and, we're just trying to get back into the settling into some normalcy, because we're traveling again in the next few days. So there's really no way for us to keep it normal with this baby, but we're doing the best we can. Anyway, he's like hanging out and I pick him up and he's feeling a little clammy, not warm, but a little clammy. I was like, this doesn't feel normal. I think we should probably just take his temperature. And this sort of like, this would never cross my mind for myself, for my wife, for anyone I've ever met as an adult. even a grown child, even like a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old, that'd be like, ah, you're fine. Like you play it off. You're, as long as you're not doing something. But he has no way of communicating with me. Even if he's behaving okay, the moment I saw something that just was slightly out of the norm, clammy skin, like, oh, you have a little bit of dampness on your forehead, kiddo. Let's take that temperature. Don't want it to be a cold. Like the fear sets in. The anxiety is real.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm covered in moles. I mean, some of them are probably even visible on video here, and I haven't been to the dermatologist in 5 years. And I mean, my mom's had skin cancer, has had skin cancer like continuously on and off for 5 years. She and I would probably both be her mom died of cancer. Like we would all be more worried about Cleo Rhodes getting the sniffles, even though that makes no logical sense because we're both caregivers. But like if Cleo Rhodes, you know, so much as like has a fever, it's the end of the world. And if you take them on a trip, they get sick afterwards. I mean, that something happens, you know, they're going to be exposed to something. So we didn't even begin traveling with Cleo until like lengths beyond like an hour until September of this year when she was, I guess 18, 19 months. She's born in February. So I guess, yeah. So we stayed. I mean, you know, we followed the rules of the pandemic because my job has always been work from home. My wife got like almost a year's worth of leave through her school where she was a counselor, and then she quit.
Hell yes. And
so, yes. I mean, we just, the situation changed, you know, it wasn't like there that was deliberate or anything, but we just haven't had a reason to take her anywhere. And so she's kind of, other than to her grandparents. And so she's kind of just visits her. She spends days, 3 days a week with her grandparents, 2 days with her maternal grandparents, one with her paternal grandparents. And so when she does go somewhere new, she seems to get sick almost immediately. So like whether you're taking them out constantly or just like taking them out one and done, it seems like the same thing will happen, which is probably for the best because they've got to catch all these colds and other things that they get. But then it's against the backdrop of a scenario right now where Cleo Rhodes has had 3 COVID tests. I have had none.
3 tests?
When she gets the sniffles, our pediatrician recommends a COVID test.
That
so we take her in, you know, Allegheny County here in Pennsylvania is very aggressive about testing. She gets tested. She said 3 negative tests.
Wow.
Yeah, she had one today.
I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine. I mean, like, we're flying with my son, and I'm ready and willing to fight anybody who even tries to like put a mask on him. I'm like, he's 3 months old. Relax.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how they're. Yeah, I mean, Cleo wouldn't wear a mask. She'd go nuts. She would go crazy. But we also haven't taken her on an airplane. She's just, she rides in the car. She watches her. If she's going on a car ride, she'll watch her tablet. No matter how much you try to keep the tablet out, that thing's coming in at some point.
Yeah, did you guys have that plan of like, you know what, we're gonna free range this kid. They're gonna have an imagination like we did when we were kids.
If I didn't have to work during the day, given how much I do, I think I could swing it. But it is beyond my wife. Like if my mom was here full time, like who is like insane, then it might be manageable. But outside of that. Cause you know, I was homeschooled up to the 9th grade. So I didn't So I didn't have a lot of, I had very selective access to certain things. Didn't mean I didn't get to do a lot of like certain things, but like other things I never encountered. Like I never got to strike a match as a kid. That's the kind of mom I had. I didn't strike a match until I was in my 30s.
Was that exciting moment for you?
Well, we were just, you know, we were lighting the Advent candles, which is the normal thing, but I had always had the clicker for that.
Yeah.
You know, cause that's safe. And so it's the first, you know, this guy was like a traditionalist and he insisted on using a match. And I was like, dude, I don't know. I've never struck a match. Never even used a lighter that wasn't one of those click lighters. Yeah. Like never used a flip lighter. Never. So that was, it's the type of thing like that. I didn't get the chicken pox till I was 16.
How did you get chicken pox at 16? You just met somebody who had had it when they were four.
My cousin also caught it at 16. We were living together at the time. We both got the chicken pox and we both missed like a quarter of the school year.
That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the only time I've had like, you know, the IV drip in and everything else to get rehydrated. Terrible, really terrible. I mean, worst, sickest I've ever been. Probably sicker than most people get from COVID now. Certainly they don't miss that much school. No. And I had like purplish scarring under my neck and everything for like months afterwards, but it did let up over time. But yeah, it was insane. Again, that's something that I think there's even a vaccine for that now, but
yes. Yeah. I think, like, I think they give that vaccine out. Like, I don't know when you're supposed to get that one. I think that one's pretty early. You get that.
I think it's in the packet. It may be in the package of what she's already gotten, but it was definitely not in the packet. I got vaccinated for all the 80s, early 80s ones.
Yeah.
So I didn't get that. And that's an example. You might, you know, if you do need to get these sicknesses, probably best, even COVID, in fact, probably best to get it sooner rather than later, because that was absolutely crippling.
Have you gotten COVID?
No. I was vaccinated back in February. You know, I think I may have had it in July. Like I had a pretty terrible week. First time I've been sick in years. It was very similar to the symptoms from the second COVID shot. So it's possible I had it, my wife had it, and Cleo had it.
Yeah, I was about
that
to
ask. That was the one time we didn't get her tested then. We didn't, none of us got tested at the one time when we probably had it, because you got to get tested within a certain time of symptom onset or something. And we were all laid up in the house. So yeah. It's possible I missed, but I had something, you know, whatever the hell it was the worst I've had in a while. I ended up missing days of work, and it's hard for me to justify missing days of work when I'm at home, but I've started taking them off. Like I have time off, like they're urgently telling me to use it. So
yeah, you're like running up against the deadline to use your time off each year, but you're like, you know what? I want to write more. Give me more content.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I could, it's one of those like take it as you need it things. That's the rule there for me. And I never need it, so I never take it. So like somebody just noticed like, oh yeah, you've taken 2 days off in the past like four. It's like, yeah, I took a long weekend. Another time I added a day to Martin Luther King Day so I could go somewhere.
What an exciting way to use your PTO. That's
yeah. My boss was just auditing that at one point because HR had her looking into it, and she was like, "Yeah, you just start taking PTO, take time off." I was like, "Oh, okay."
Like Oliver, our system has flagged you. You have really big red flag here. You're like, "Oh my God, is everything okay? Like what's been going on?" Yeah, you actually are working a little bit too much there, sir.
Yeah. Well, that's a terrible thing. Like, as much as I critique the system in different places, I'm very much a bad example of it, because I'm constantly grinding. You know, the grind sect.
Yeah, it never stops. And I'm curious, because it sounds like, and we spoke about this very, very briefly beforehand, like while we were organizing this, and I've seen you talk about your dad a ton on your Twitter, and
he's a character.
I've read some pieces that you've written about him. I mean, is there someone that is even, is it possible there's anyone in your life more influential on your like grind than your dad?
No. He looms large, even though he's no longer with us. No, there's no, you know, both in terms of like demonstrating how to work the grind and how not to work it. And both of those things, I think he is sort of like, I don't think anybody ever studied another person, maybe like Boswell studying Samuel Johnson or something when he's writing the biography of him, like I studied my dad, because I would, like I said, I was homeschooled till the ninth grade. My dad would come home every day for lunch when he was working, and so he was always there. And then, you know, when he's taking days off, as he often did, he was just there, so we were just there. So I studied him intently, and he is truly an influence for good or for ill, because you know when he was stringing together work, he was very prolific, and when he wasn't working, he was like crashing and burning, you know, like he was like, work 3 months, like 3 months of continuous work, 2 months of rest type of guy. And so that was sort of the model that I saw. And what I've tried to do, what this has ended up doing for me is kind of, I probably overwork as a result, not out of any like, you know, like tremendous like cultural pressure, but just out of this like individual, I've had moments of like extreme privation. No, you know, the family has literally run out of money despite once having lots of it. Like it just decided to stop working and waste all the money. Just literally, why'd you do it? Well, you know, just being ornery. just decided to call it. I saw a white light, told me to stop working. And so I've tried never to. Now I'm still in the age range before that. He was 42 when I was born. So I'm still in the age range before this like late 40s decline began for him. So I think some of this is just me worrying that like, when am I going to have my moment when, you know, I'm talking about no longer working and going to live in a park school bus down on the Pitt County line or something like that, or writing to my old high school girlfriend to get her to buy a house for me in Montana.
Wow. Because
I don't have any money, which she did.
Wow. I mean,
63 years old, hasn't spoken to her in 45 years, finds her name through a skip tracing service back in 2002. They start dating again, and then they buy a house, and then they're living in Montana. And that's how he lived there until he died in his bed.
Wow.
He died penniless. I mean, all of his money was gone, but he lived pretty large up until the end. And he told me that's why he never explained to her why he dumped her. You always leave one in reserve.
Holy shit.
It was truly a long game. It was like, it was truly a long game. It was like when his fourth marriage had ended, he had this one ready to roll where he was like, well, you know, with Suzanne, we never quite wrapped this up. And maybe, you know, maybe she still
45
thinks
years later.
Yeah. She had just gotten divorced as well, or like within a recent period. So it was perfect for him to, you know, kind of come back in. He had been a real all-star back in high school, and so he still had a lot of his stock was still pretty high. Also between marriages, he would usually lose his typical 40 to 50 pounds. The overall weight would increase steadily over time, but he would drop the
excess
weight
between,
yeah so he would get down, he'd hit the stepper, he'd hit the weights. So he was looking pretty good for 63, quite strong for 63. That would be his last hurrah, and then he would gradually balloon up once again before he had a heart attack, had a couple heart attacks, and then passed away. But he had it all laid out. He wanted to live to be 75. He did. He wanted to die in his own bed. He did. And he wanted to live out his last years in Montana away from people. And he did. So that life will never be duplicated. But I also don't want to model that behavior for my daughter. Like, I just want her to see, you know, that I worked and put in all this time to provide material benefit to her. But at the same time, there's this, like, if my dad were alive, he would be telling me, like, son, you're a sucker. By the time you're 50, she's not even going to want to talk to you. And, you know, whereas I had the time of my life, and you still talk to me till the day I died.
I don't even know how to pick that apart. That's
no.
I
know he would say it too. He probably wrote it in an email somewhere. I know he would say it.
I've spoken to a bunch of different dads, and one common theme is a lot of it is like, how do you How do you include the things from your father that you want and then edit out or remove the things from your dad that you didn't, that you don't want?
But that's all. I mean, that's really what I'm doing. I mean, my dad was a genius at cobbling together different types of jobs, but he had a bad tendency to go off the wagon and go on sort of, you know, benders and go on sprees and just let it all crumble. So he was like, I want to just do the building without the collapse and the rebuilding. Like he told me he loved making comebacks. I don't want to have to keep making comebacks. Now I've had setbacks in my own life in different ways, and I've had to, some of them, most of them involved him. And so I had to make comebacks as well. And he loved a comeback. He's like, you know, there's nothing you can sell better than a comeback story. Everybody likes a comeback, you know, comeback player of the year.
I mean, yeah, I guess it's true in sports for a season or one game, or, you know, no one's ever going to forget Brady and, you know, the Patriots and the Falcons. No one's ever going to forget that. But it's a little bit different with being a dad or having a dad. That I think stability goes a long way, right?
Yeah, you don't need a dad to have bug out plans. Like, if you don't need a dad to have, like, here's my plan for getting my wife arrested if she tries to get me arrested, which I actually executed, which he did execute in 1996, and, like, you know, walked scot free. She had to go through quite an ordeal. Truly, I mean, like, and he had plans like this for everything. Like, you got to do something to him, but he had a comeback, because, like, he would tell me, and some of the stuff you've likely read, it's you or me, buddy. You better want it to be you, because I'm gonna want it to be me.
I didn't believe. I don't know what else to say. I did not believe that your dad was that way. I didn't
there's
believe
something
he was
lovable about him. Anyway,
oh, for sure.
And then people have offered different interpretations of that. I mean, some people remember him explaining that. Maybe some have said, like, well, he was in his 60s then, so he probably assumed that you would kill him and that would make him happy if you guys fought, because you would have done what he wanted, because he couldn't have won at that point or something. I'm like, no, that dude was just never going to go down. Like, he's, you know, if you like watch those two videos, if you watch those videos of like a bull goring a lion and the lion still is able to kill the bull before it dies, that was my dad. Like, you weren't getting out unscathed.
No.
And he was going to get his before he got, like Marshawn Lynch said. He was going to get his more than he got, though. Like, also, like Marshawn Lynch said. I mean, long before Marshawn Lynch ever said that, that was the attitude I was raised with every day. You know, I'm going to get mine, so you better get yours.
Is this where the work comes from? Is this where the work is born?
The work means a whole bunch of things. My mom is a really strict Catholic, so the work is actually a reference to, and although she can't be a part of it, but the work is actually a reference to among other things, Opus Dei, which is sometimes called the work. It's a reference to doing the work, which is this kind of like empty phrase that people say now. It's a reference to actually working, which I do. I work around the clock. And, you know, it's a reference to working people. As my dad said, you always got to be working people. It's a reference to pro wrestlers working the crowd, which is a more or less the same thing. Like, I work in marketing, so I know when, like, a phrase like that, when I began using it, that's when the follower count went up. It was very deliberate. Like, it's a phrase, all the phrases, like, they all mean like 52 different things. And so the work means all of those things. But it's the kind of thing he would have come up with. A lot of the stuff that I write and say is stuff that he probably talked about with me, but just couldn't execute in this type of form. You know, he just couldn't. This wasn't his area. You know what I mean? Like, being on a podcast wouldn't have been his thing, or writing an article, or working on a value proposition or something like that. But in like a small scale, like writing a newspaper ad, or TV, local TV commercial, he would have, or, you know, the jingle for the car dealership, he would have done something like that. But I watched all that and I've adapted it to what I do all day. Basically, like when he was working, he worked round the clock, like everything was part of the work. You know, he didn't separate work and life. Like he was always doing something. He was always like, he always had some little deal going. He always had some other job he was doing for somebody. And he just kept track of it. Like he kept track. I mean, I have pretty detailed Excel spreadsheets and things like that. But if my wife didn't want those to be there, I wouldn't keep them. Or if my boss didn't want like large amounts of record keeping and like Airtables or smart sheets or something, I would just run it off the, you know, what's upstairs. Yeah. God forbid you start to lose your mind though. That's kind of what happens. Like if you start getting dementia or Alzheimer's, that whole system falls apart.
It does, very quickly.
My brother had a story about my dad. My half brother was drafted into running the parts department of my dad's Chrysler dealership. Because we like to run with like four employees tops in a franchise car dealership, 3 to 4, keep it lean.
That's right.
Always keep it lean. So it fell to Sam when he was 16 or 17 to basically go through and just do the books with the aid of just a bookkeeper, not an accountant, to just do the books for the entire back of the house. And so they worked for weekend after weekend and finally got everything straight, like years of records just that weren't being turned into Mopar, which was like the company, like the name for the Dodge parts or whatever. They pulled all of that together. And my dad looked at it and he's like, oh, son of a bitch, son, you got to throw this away. He's like, if I can understand what's going on here, they certainly can too. And Sam was like, who's they? And he's like, anyone that might be looking into what I'm doing here.
That's amazing.
He's like, there's a way you do this. So it looks like you tried to do your due diligence, but you didn't have a clue what you were doing. You just confused the hell out of them.
So the clarity was the issue. The fact that it was actually done to a certain degree of actual end result makes sense to somebody. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there are better examples of this out there. Like there's a 30 for 30 ESPN special on the guy that basically committed massive wire fraud to buy the New York Islanders and like would slow walk, like replying to like when he would get cornered on something like, when's this transfer coming in or where's this money coming from? He had an excuse. He almost like secured ownership of the team for good. He would have been able to sell it and make a profit had he reached that stage. What my dad did money-wise was stuff very similar to that. It just on a lower, like less ambitious. Like he didn't have a plan to buy a sports team. But that was sort of the nature of all of this stuff. It all involved a lot of confusion. It relied heavily on like systems in the 70s and 80s not catching up.
Sure.
Like today things are immediate. But in the 80s, 90s, you could fudge documents, make things look like other things, like screw things up, like smudge things on the facts. I mean, he was a master of all this type of stuff. So I watched that type of work go on. And he would always talk about, you know, you're buying yourself another week or another month or another year or whatever. But what drives me, honestly, is just not wanting to have to stoop to that kind of stuff. I mean, as interesting as it was exciting, I guess, in a way, looking back on it, it was kind of exciting. By comparison, what I do now is very boring. But I just wouldn't want to put my family through those kind of ups and downs. You know, it was hard enough leaving academia for a job in the corporate world and moving back home to Pittsburgh from Texas and other things we had to do. And even then, there was no period when we weren't earning. You know what I mean? But like this guy from 82 to 99 when he retired, probably worked 6 years out of those two.
Wow.
Out of that whole stretch, I think 6 real years. How do you do that? And like live in nice houses and buy, like have nice stuff. How do you swing it? He did for a while. And then, you know, I and then really what happened is he just wore out. he just couldn't keep, he couldn't keep yeah, it up.
It caught up with him.
And he decided to tap out.
Too exhausting. Know?
Yeah, he actually he had a rigid religious revelation at a car dealer's convention in Tampa. He said, saw a white light. It told him he wouldn't have to work again. And so instead of trying to sell the dealership, he decided to let it run itself into the ground.
That's
so he would just be at home in his tidy whities, like stretched out over the floor, laying back. And I would be home too because I was being homeschooled and. You know,
these,
oh, I'm not going in there today. Oh, your brother's there. My brother had to dropped out his senior year of high school to run the car dealership. Came back a year later and finished. Not many kids were made, not many parents used their kids quite like that. Like I was put into a typing class at age 10, at Pitt County Community College, like a clerical skills class, so I could learn how to run the front of the house by the time I was 12 or 13. And since I was being homeschooled, theoretically, I would be able to be moved into that role.
It's almost like how farms were run for like a million years, basically.
Yeah, yeah. The oldest technology in the world, he'd say. Kids,
yeah. That's exactly what
we're talking about, kids, but that was how he honestly, he wanted to leave the business. He wanted to, in some weird way, he wanted to create, that was why he went into like a legitimate business after years of fairly illegitimate ones, like having a franchise car dealership in his mind in the 80s would have been sort of the big thing. His kids would pass it on and develop it and grow it, and we would do better. We'd be better educated than he was, and we would grow up in the business and have it. And instead, you know, we didn't have it, but that was the plan. I would run the front of the house. My brother, and it's funny because my brother like works in parts for International Harvester, you know, has a very good job doing that. And I work in marketing, running the front of the house. So really it did. The split did turn out exactly. And like the thing that people ask me, like the thing that paid off the most, like, We talked about like how you know me or whatever, or how I do this stuff. I type 125 words a minute with not like 97-98% accuracy. I did it. I did then. I do now. I learned on the old typewriters. And so I can do work a lot faster than people think I can. So like I have a 1,000 word piece for print for the Washington Examiner that I know is due tomorrow night. I know it's going to take me 90 minutes to write it. I've already kind of clicked it off here. It's a really nice per word rate, but I know it's going to take 90 minutes to do it perfectly. And it's a sports piece on, you know, NCAA doing away with the SAT qualifying requirements for athletes. And it's just ready to roll. I just have to, just like I budgeted time for this, I just have to budget time for that, knock it out tomorrow night, turn it in, it'll be good. But that skill, that one skill, because what I've seen, you know, in my role hiring younger people to come up as like marketing specialists and stuff, starting out in that field, in the past 20 years, typing on a mechanical keyboard, those skills have degraded. Touch phones have degraded the
can swipe words out.
Yeah, and you just do this, which isn't that. Mm-hmm. And as a result, like those skills are in short supply. People, I would say a lot of them are 40 words a minute tops. That means you can do work three times faster than somebody. That means you can do this type of work three times faster than somebody. And the more of it you do, the more of it you can do. And it stacks, you know, it compounds in that sense. So I think it's hilarious that typing is like it, they'll never be able to dictate faster than I can type.
Right.
I could dictate pretty well, but I would never need to because I could type faster. Because again, that was the old man, you know, you don't ever need a secretary. You're your own best secretary. You don't need anybody to, like the Prince of Wales, you don't need anybody to hold your thing when you pee or whatever they do with it. That was my dad's big line. You don't need somebody to do that. Do it yourself and save one salary slot.
The difference that I'm sort of picking up, the difference that I'm picking up between how your dad had this, like, you know, the mindset sounds like and feels almost like always cornered, always ready to find a way out of the corner, whether there actually was a corner or not. You know, there's just the facade of a corner, the mindset of being able to like fight through a trapped scenario, you know, lone wolf deal. And you're talking like early on, you're talking, oh yeah, we built the porch where the Cleo Rose is taking over the all their house. You know, we're moving our stuff into the basement. It's like night and day difference, right? Did you have to like consciously come to a decision of, I am going to shape my life around the family unit and the value there?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it was a decision that by virtue of starting a family and, you know, staying married for 10 plus years, it was just something that I was doing because I had seen the consequences of letting those things slip. I mean, it was funny because my dad had said, you know, if you get married, marry a woman whose parents did not divorce. My wife's parents, there's no history of divorce in her family, like direct line going back at all, which is interesting for baby boomers. A lot of them have parents who got divorced. My parents combined for 8 divorces. So
that's like a hobby at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. They're obviously not tied down in the same way. But he gave me advice like this, like basic statistics, you know, basic probabilities. You know, if you find someone like that, then they're more likely to stick it out with you. You could accumulate assets. And he would say at times, like, he fucked up. You divorce that many times, you're spreading yourself really thin. You're going to lose a lot of money. You're going to have duplicate houses. You're going to have duplicate, duplicate sets of bills. So it was conscious in that sense. It was conscious in the sense that it's obviously a better thing to do. Like, I still probably feel cornered the way he might have, but I know rationally that I'm not like trapped in any kind of corner or anything like that. But it's a decision that was important that I, you know, my wife, it was important to us that we build this stuff together, save money, work off a budget each month, do these things, try to support each other to move up in our jobs, rely on each other's personal networks to get the jobs that our last couple of jobs we've gotten through who we knew.
Yeah.
You know, specifically who we knew here in our hometown. Whether it was someone I knew, a job for her, or someone she knew, and the job that I have moved up in. And those are just, it's just an alternative strategy. I think he would still mock it at times. Like he mocked his brother when his brother was trying to, in my dad's words, go straight, you know, like working good jobs, buying a nice house, getting married, these sorts of things.
Yeah, the picket.
But at the other time, he would advise us to do this. So mixed messages were a big part of his thing. But you got to keep them on their toes.
Yeah,
keeping things on. Keeping people on their toes, keep staying on your own toes was a big part of his like life lesson. You know, whole life on your toes. You know, never, always on your toes, never on your heels, never on your back foot, always going. And so, but at the same time, like, I think the general message to me was probably better to do it this way because the long term, it'll pay off in the long run. You don't want your long game to be having to like hit up an ex flame that you dumped unceremoniously, basically on your first day of college, to deal with your retirement. You know, I mean, that's a better retirement situation than some folks have. I mean, I'm grateful that she was able to take care of him because I couldn't have at that time, but that's not a viable strategy.
No.
And but he was, you know, such a dark temperament that he would still say, oh, but you could do everything right, son. It'll still fuck up. You know, $5,000, $500, $500 million. Doesn't matter if you shit it away. could be gone in a heartbeat. You know, me, and it could be your own heartbeat when you have a heart attack.
Your own heartbeat, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was his. That was his big thing. I mean, he really hammered home sort of the pointlessness of it all. But at the same time, he seemed, I'm sure he was torn in his own way too. But that's definitely the big takeaway. I tried to take away the stable lessons.
Yeah.
That he put forward. You know?
Are you? So you were homeschooled, so you got exposed to this a lot in your very important formative years. Is this something that you're planning on doing with your daughter, or are you going to just let her actually go to a school? And
I think we'll relocate to a house in the suburbs and a district probably before she begins school. Whether that's 3 years or 5 years or whatever, even though we're doing a lot here, because you know you don't want to put. What you could be putting towards equity, you don't want to be putting towards a private school. That's dumb. I think homeschooling was incredibly valuable for me. I mean, to be able to do the stuff that I do, I don't think my parents had no idea they were preparing me for the changing nature of work, but in a way they were. I mean, everything that we did is stuff that, obviously, I wasn't writing takes or things like that, but the ability to just pick apart or put together my own curriculum, explain it, write essays about it, that's literally what I got to do. Yeah, you know, Oliver, pick your maths for the day. Oliver, pick your reading for the day. Oliver, pick a movie and tell me about what you watched it. Talk about what actually happens in the film, how it's shot, what the story is, what the plot is. I mean, that was what my parents pushed, and that was how they both, like, questions, answering questions, being able to respond, being able to construct this stuff. I think in a way, for my own temperament as a kid, it was much better than going to school. You know, it was weird when I did start high school. I was 12, so it was a weird experience to go in there with the kids at that age. But I was so fat that it didn't really, like, you know, like, I wasn't too, like, size wise, I was just like a fatter version of the same height I am now and everything almost. So there weren't problems like that. But yeah, it was a weird experience to go into the regular school because there was a lot of structure, but not as much content.
Yeah.
And what we have today at the work for home world. Yeah. There are scheduled Zooms on my daily calendar and stuff. And there's the podcast is a Zoom. This is a Zoom, whatever. But a lot of the content I have to work through that myself. So I have books that I'm reading at any given time. I have, you know, things I'm watching through at any given time. I have things that I'm writing at any given time. And they're all just lists that I'm going down and checking off, just like I did back then. So I think what they set up actually was a great way for me. I don't know if it would be a great way for Cleo. I mean, I think it would depend on her disposition. It would depend on my mom and my wife have very different temperaments. I don't think it's not good parental practice to just leave your kid at home from 8 till 5, even if one of you comes home for lunch.
I wouldn't recommend it.
But somehow they had total confidence in me. Like I'd be left with like advice, like don't touch the stove. You know, people would ask my mom, like, well, why do you think he's not going to burn down the house? And she's like, he just won't. It's like, why do you think he won't go outside? He just won't.
The trap.
I don't know if I can say that about Cleo.
The trap is that you can look back at it and they were right. But your mom was right.
They're totally right about how to educate me.
You're sitting here right now, like you've done pretty well. You're like you're working really hard. You seem, you know, reasonably well put together. You're taking care of yourself and your family. I mean, at least, you know, the there's survivorship bias in the examples here.
No, I actually loved homeschool because no one was there. I was left completely alone. Like the best time, it still is. I mean, I love my family, but I still like my alone time, my 4-hour life or my 4HL. You know, when I can just kick back, read like an hour or two of reading, an hour or two of this, or an hour of exercise, which I just finished before this started. and that's my time, and nobody is bugging me, and it's so peaceful, you know. Just this, like, the, it's not quite as peaceful as that was, but there was a lot less peace when they all got home. So
yeah,
but to just be able to sit at home and like, if, oh, I just want to read these three books, like, didn't matter that they weren't in some school curriculum. If I wanted to read Watership Down like 9 times in a row, I could read it 9 times in a row as long as I had something else to say about it. You know, and some books like, you know, like the Once and Future King, I probably did read 9 or 10 times in a row. Don't know why, but just, you know what I mean? Like, just, yeah. Or if I wanted to read a wrestling magazine that day, like some old, I would buy old 1970s back issues of those, like Bill Apter, Western wrestling magazines. I would buy old, you know, like Weider muscle magazines and stack them up. And so that seemed weird. You know, why would a kid put his allowance toward this? But I use that too.
Like, you
I can write the rest of the house.
You deadlift the house now, so yeah. You know, it all works out.
And I write about the stuff. Like, that's the thing. Like, all of what fitness has cost me, or what wrestling cost me on the front end, it has made me that much more on the back end. And I haven't had to take a single bump in the wrestling ring, or use a steroid, or sell a steroid, or any of those things.
Yeah.
You know, like it is, the payoff has been so enormous. And it's exactly what the, you know, my old man would say, this stuff would come back around one day. And my mom would sometimes question that, like, well, you know, shouldn't he read Great Expectations instead of this, you know, instead of this, like, what's superstar Billy Graham doing right now? Or can anyone beat Larry Scott in 1966 for the Mr. Olympia? shouldn't he be reading something normal, you know, instead of this kind of weird material? And he would just say, no, as long as he's got something to say about it, he can read it. That was his take on anything. Like, if I wanted to watch the movie Predator, like 6 or 7 years old, and I did, you know, I watched that movie probably every week until I was 12 or 13 years old. I watched that VHS tape at least once a week. But I started watching it when I was either 5 or 6. Like, an R rating on a movie meant nothing to my parents, about, like, as long, it could be like buckets of blood, like Dead Alive levels of blood, like lawnmower running into the bodies. The only thing that they would like object to would be not even like sexual content, but like romance. So a movie could have sex, but not romance, or vast amounts of blood, and I could watch it. But if it contained adult themes like a romance, I wasn't allowed to watch it.
Right.
So I could watch Predator, but not Pretty Woman. Or I wasn't allowed to watch Dirty Dancing for some reason, but I could watch Roadhouse.
That's the correct Swayze movie to
binge. but I don't understand. Like, they had all of these restrictions.
Okay.
Like,
okay. Hold on a second though. So your parents had all these weird restrictions that you didn't understand as a kid.
Oh.
I guarantee you right now, if you looked at the way that you restrict, like, you know, Cleo Rose, or even what you're planning on, you're going to be able to look at it and be like, she's not going to get any of this. I'm not saying that your parents actually had some sort of, like, you know, grand plan that they were attempting to execute appropriately. I'm just saying maybe there isn't really a lot of clarity into the decision-making process.
No, I think you're right. In my dad's case, I think it came down to the end of, I watched things that he thought didn't suck. So, like, Big Trouble in Little China, fine, you know, good. Nightmare on Elm Street, he didn't like it, so he didn't watch it. Although he would watch it or go to the theater to see each one of them as they came out. But he didn't like them enough to let me watch them. So there
you
was
had
just
your own little casemaker.
Yeah. Definitely. And I have, like, he censored movies by his, and everything by his own standards. Like, you know, it was perfectly normal to watch hours a day of pro wrestling, because it would be on in like 8-hour blocks, like showing old regional wrestling, WBF wrestling. I'd just sit there. But if I like tried to put Mr. Rogers on the TV, my dad would be like, oh, look at this, look at this weirdo. This is weird shit. Turn this off.
Him and his cardigan.
Yeah. He thought that was really creepy. He thought Sesame Street was really creepy. But watching like men pose or like fight each other in the wrestling ring, that was not only okay, but to be encouraged, you know, for a kid of 5, 6, 7 years old, that was perfectly fine.
Do you see the echoes of, like, even just, do you ever take a second and pause and see the echoes of your father or your mother's behavior coming in and how you're interacting with your daughter without even realizing that's part of the decision that you're making right there? You're like, wait a second, I'm definitely doing dad things right now. Like I'm being my old man.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely things that my wife, she has her watching content, like they'll watch Mr. Rogers and I'll always make a remark about it because I think it's a little odd, you know. Or I fought, you know, like Cleo Rose and I, like when we roughhouse, like we call it fighting. Like Cleo Rose knows what it means to fight. Like she gets tossed in the air, thrown around. But because we always did as kids, like we were fighting the old man from like as soon as we could go at it, you know, fighting each other as soon as we could go at it. That was just something my dad encouraged.
Did you have sisters or you have only brothers?
Oh, God. I have a half brother and then I have two cousins that I lived with in my teen years that basically are brothers. It was all men. At one point it was my dad, his brother, their two kids. It's like a house of all men.
Yeah.
You know, and at that point this stuff really began to intensify, like meals that were more like feeds, you know, a situation with flatulence that got so bad, they finally had to ban it on the first floor of the house. Like one-upsmanship just made the, and dairy just made the house like unbearable.
Yeah.
Became the downstairs feral. Bathroom. It was a feral
family. Yeah.
So I got to experience, in addition to years of my mom, who's very controlling and her own way, I got to experience like what a life of all men, like a true man's world. And I mean, like neither my dad nor his brother were dating at that time. They were in a real woman hating environment too, or just like not even that, just like no women allowed environment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Remember, my dad went on a date with a woman at one point, a woman named, her name was Sunny or Judith or something. And he brought her back to he brought her back to my uncle's townhome. Yeah, and they're just sitting on the easy chair together that like we would normally watch football on or something. She's sitting in his lap, and the three of us, including his brother, are seated around the couch. And there's a woman in the setting, like they're like, you know, kind of, you know, it's public display of affection stuff right there. And I remember thinking, at like 12 or 13, I guess I would have been, it would have been 97. I would have been 15. I think I'm thinking like, I know I'm thinking that what's going, like, I like my brain couldn't even process the idea of dating.
Right.
But there's my dad on this date. And then, you know, for like a month afterwards, my dad is driving this woman's BMW. I have no idea why. You know, she gives him her older car and he's just allegedly, he didn't have a car. Allegedly his car is in the shop. So he's just tooling around town in this vehicle. That was when I had to, my job after school was to run my dad's Who personals page.
Wow.
Yeah. So I began writing correspondence back to all of the
all
women.
That typing. All that typing came into play.
Yeah, I began taking down his correspondence. And when he got married to a woman he met off Yahoo Personals, I was the architect of all of the emails until they met. And then, you know, then the truth came out slowly over the course of that marriage. But I was sort of the Cyrano de Bergerac of that union. And sometimes my cousin Charlie was also working the old man's personal ad. And again, like neither of us dated in high school. So I didn't even go to a school dance. I didn't go to a prom. I didn't go. I mean, I graduated when I was 16. I had just turned 16 in May of the year that I graduated in June. And so I never went to a school dance. I never, I don't think I, understood that you could what a date was until like midway through college, and by then I was so busy working and being in school that I had no, it just didn't hit me till my probably my early to mid 20s what that even was.
So
it was just so alien. Like a lot of people today, you know, kids today or, you know, Gen Z or whatever, talk a lot about sex and sexuality and dating. I did not have a single thought about that until my early to mid 20s, if any. I thought about eating like a big steak after my shift ended. I know that sounds fucking stupid, but I, like, if you offered me a date or a steak, I probably even into my, well, probably at, like at any point, I would take the steak, especially if it's dry aged beef. Yeah. I'd take that over.
It depends on the steak.
Take that over the date. Yeah, definitely dry aged beef, tomahawk ribeye. I would take that over the date, especially if I didn't have to do the cleanup afterwards.
Okay, hold on a second. We, okay. How did you end up getting married and having a child? At what point did you think to yourself, you know what?
When I was in law school from 04 to 07, I dated a couple folks. And then when I was in grad school from 07 to 12, getting the PhD, I dated people at Pitt.
Okay. So you,
and
you
it just, I yeah.
enter the dating.
Yeah. Field. Yeah. And like initially it was a way to have somebody to go out to restaurants with. I, you know, especially in Chicago, I ate a lot of junk food during that time when I was living out that way. And so it was great to have somebody to eat these massive meals with. And then later on, you know, I began to understand like there's a progression associated with this. And I think it took a while for that to kick in. And it wasn't probably until dating my wife that there were a lot of near misses and like mistakes and things where I, perhaps the relationship could have like evolved, but I just continued to do the same thing. And I wasn't done with my PhD yet, you know, so I wasn't like ready to commit to anything. A lot of it was timing, but like people, I didn't even occur to me that people had stages of this. Mm-hmm. Like that you get, you know, that like they're, or at least maybe they still do. I don't know, but like you like have an engagement. Like I ever saw my parents have engagements prior to marriage, or like they have like pre-wedding events or wedding events. The parents just, my parents got common law married in the state of Pennsylvania. The time limit ran. In fact, that wasn't even legal because my dad's first wife didn't die till 89. So she was still alive while cohabiting with my mother. She was in the hospital. She had bad MS. And so I saw none of this growing up. So truly I was like raised by wolves in that sense. And it didn't occur to me. I had to learn it later on. I know that seems very, very weird, but I just didn't know what it was. I think I missed a lot of this, like at the same time, I think I missed probably a lot of the heartbreak or pain or just confusion that a lot of kids have, because I was just focused. I was just focused on different things, and by the time it came around to doing that, I was like older, you know, like the clock had already ticked on being really stupid. I mean, the only thing I was just really not committed.
Yeah.
Initially, like, you know, just a guy that liked to eat out meals and big meals and lived in a studio, you know, in grad school, and don't want to be in that studio too long after I ate a big meal, because the bathroom was right there, you know, and the futon was right there, and it wasn't.
that sounds not romantic.
Had a few relationships end for that reason.
Yeah, that's not.
Did not learn until later. That just so repulsive. Apparently,
where's the Roadhouse barn, man? Come on, like you couldn't put the barn together. You couldn't have the old Mercedes.
No, well, I was in a big city. I lived in a small studio. I, at the time, I liked that kind of compressed living because it forced me to go outside all the time, use the city, you know, hang out with people at their places. And it was a good move overall. But for that type of like having people over and you've got like 200 square feet.
That's not it.
No. And I mean, you know, they look at your place and it's a futon. Literally just a futon that's in bed form, and they're like, you just, you mean like you What are you bringing
make yourself
me in
at home.
To do? Yeah, what do you? I just sit here on the bed with me, and we'll. You know what I mean? Like, it's not. I was such an idiot. I like there's an obvious implication just having a bed in your house. Then the house is only the bed and a bathroom, you know. And I don't know. I'm glad
there's
that
only two wrong. Things that happens here.
Yes, kitchen and a fucking fridge full of milk.
You apply yourself. Okay, so I'm getting to know you a little bit over this podcast, and I. It's hilarious. I now understand why you've never ever run out of something to write about, because you have an infinite takes, dude. Infinite opinions, yeah. Infinite experience, infinite takes. And I love it. It's fantastic. I'm curious through the application of yourself, because you seem to be very clearly methodical. You like put yourself into the thing that you're doing at the moment, apparently with quite a lot of zest and verve. You just like get after it when you get after it. How do you balance all the work with your wife, with that relationship, with the new kid? I mean, Cleo Rose is 20 months, so it's not quite new anymore, but it's pretty new compared to the experience you've had in your life.
It's a big challenge. I don't think I'm doing the best job of it. I'm doing a solid job, but I don't think any dad can really be super successful at that. You know, like you can't get something without giving something up. And so right now to do all the different, like to have all the revenue streams, as they might say, in like the gig world, like they used to say second revenue streams, third revenue stream. To have stuff come in, plus the main thing, there are inevitably consequences. And so despite being, I'm just very fortunate that I'm at home, because I couldn't do this. The commute alone would cut into the time that I use to do this and have any time for my family. And so honestly, on Saturdays in particular, but Sunday afternoons usually as well, Saturdays and Sundays from like 9 a.m. until 6 p.m. I'm with Cleo Rose doing stuff, unless there's like some truly major project either at work or like a big, big money project hits. I always record the podcast at this time of night, so they don't really, unless it's somebody in England the time limit over there, the time zone over there is so screwed up, you have to record at like 9 a.m. But yeah, I get time with them, but I don't think any of us get the time that we would like. And I think it's a challenge, because, kids will just, they'll take as much time as you give them, like they could just have infinite time. As your little one gets older and older, you'll see that just the desire for a gaga, as my daughter calls me, is just immense. Gaga enters the room, or mama, whoever's not in the room enters the room, and it's like a huge, huge guest appearance, and everything stops, and you gotta pick her up and hug her and all of that. And I think the challenge of all this stuff is that you feel like you're cutting corners everywhere, even if you're doing the best you can. You always feel like, this is a 50% paper, and that's a 55% work assignment, and that's a 70% podcast, and that's a 25% daddy-daughter outing, and that's a, 10% diaper change. And you know what I mean? Like you start grading yourself on that, or if you're like me, you do, and you realize that you're just not, I think that every parent gets to that, and I think some can cope with it, and some feel bad, and some feel bad on behalf of their kids, which can't be good. My parents never felt any guilt that they weren't able to really be there for me. If there's one thing they didn't feel, it was that. But yeah, it's just a challenge. I think anybody listening to this would understand. It's probably going through. I mean, as zany as, if the story sounds zany, like you've pointed out at certain points, they're all still reflective of the same things that everybody's going through as they get older. as they go through this stuff, like, you know, what parts of my parents am I going to keep? How am I going to maintain a work-life balance? How am I going to, you know, how am I going to make this work? And you're just, some nights you're just so fucking tired that, I mean, like, I'll get a 20-minute cat nap, letting a YouTube of, like, you know, Jimmy Weaver's old boxing matches or something, or Mike Weaver's old boxing matches run on YouTube. just
trying because. To catch anything. Yeah.
Well, just while it'll put me to sleep. And then in like 20 minutes, I'll bolt upright. And then if it's a good 20-minute nap, I'll have enough gas to get through the next 3 hours of whatever I do. But yeah, I mean, I drop at like 7 after eating. So like 7:10, 7:20, I drop and got to get a quick cat nap, pop back into it. Work out on the weekends when she's napping. I try to work out during the day. Sometimes my mom comes on a weekend day, so I get the morning to myself. But yeah, I mean, anybody listening to this is going to find achieving the right balance is so difficult. You're constantly going to be reevaluating it.
Is there a direction you're headed towards? Is there an end point you're headed towards in which you're, you know, it's more time with Cleo Rhodes.
Yeah, I'd like to move up in the type of work that I do to the point at which I could abandon all of the other revenue streams.
Yeah.
I mean, I've talked about that on them. I mean, as much as I enjoy doing them or just do them occasionally, because not that I don't like doing those things, it's just they would be the easiest cuts to make. And I got to cut somewhere so that I can have the normal evening schedules that people have.
Yeah. Like you can have time for not just working and, you know, sort of grinding down.
I think I got about 3 more years to 5 years that I can do of this, like this. And then I got to pull back, you know. I mean, my wife will be back doing therapy again. So she'll sub in all of what I'm currently making and then a little bit more. And then I'll be able to draw back. Like if Cleo Rhodes starts school, like that will be a time when I can probably actually have less to do.
Yeah, but then you're going to have more time. So you'll do more.
Yeah, I mean, I'm somebody that's really hard to, like, I'll fill that time. And so I can't, but in my, like, you know, in my heart, that's what I would like to do. I've always thought that though. And then I find another thing to do, or I've always thought that. And then something else comes up and I'm just really active. I mean, my mom, you know, goes from the beginning to the end of the day. She doesn't have as many productive activities as I do, but like, she's like cleaning the house every day, or she's cutting the shrubs every day, or she's just never stops. Like her dad was like that. Like they're just, and so that's kind of where I get that. I don't know what I would do if I didn't have something to fill all that time. And, but at the same time, I do think like in 3 years or 5 years, will that be enough of all this? Will I have done what I wanted to do? Maybe I won't. I don't know. But I mean, I think everybody, when they get to a certain age, thinks about that too. Like, how much longer can I do it like this? If I have to, I will, you know, just like anybody else. If I have to do it, I will do it. But in an ideal state, in 5 years, I would be living close to my mom's family farm in Scenery Hill, Pennsylvania, on a hillside in a big house, working during the day, and then just sitting out on my like big back porch at night, and just sort of reading or something, putzing around. Maybe that's 10 years off. I don't know, but it's not impossible. I mean, like, that's not an impossible dream.
No, not at all. Did it? I know we're running up on all the time here. I don't want to take up too much more of your time here, but I was curious. I had asked earlier, you know, if you had any sisters, and then you described that you at one point were being raised essentially in like a feral man household.
Yes.
Did it freak you out having a daughter?
No. I mean, after that type of upbringing and after, I think it's easier for me to conceive of raising a girl. And I know there's a huge conversation about gender and this and that. I mean, we're just using the conventional girl here. It's easier to conceive of raising a girl now than a boy. And I think that she'll benefit from stuff that I'll bring to the table to ensure that she has the full range of experiences that kids would have all across the board. Like she's gonna have like a sports experience. She's gonna have a this if she wants it. She's gonna have a this experience. She's gonna have a that experience. She's gonna have a training experience.
Yeah, does she lift with you? Does she work out with you? Is she interested in it?
She and I do a lot of different stuff. Like we'll roll on the floor. We'll do like forward and backward rolls on the floor. She's still trying to get her roll down, but she wants to roll. Like if you tell her, she'll put her head down to go into her roll. And we do like a lot of like little gymnastics things. And I know she's gonna want to do more of that. We chase each other around the house. Go. Take turns getting each other. I mean, she just likes to fight. Cleo Rose is gonna wanna do that stuff, and so I think no. Like in terms of, if anything, I think it taught me that. I mean, as weird as that was, my mom wasn't a stereotypical mom in that sense. Like there were never really like, my family kind of moved beyond things that we still talk about, like gender roles, into their own strange thing decades ago. So I think Cleo Rose will have a fun go of it. I hope that she can avoid some of the stupid shit the way I did as a kid. Like the one thing about homeschooling and then later the way I went through high school and having my cousins live with me who were like also my best friends and like that we just video gamed or worked out or whatever all the time. I missed out on a lot of like the socialization that's supposedly normal, but I also learned never to care about what anybody thinks. I like marketing, of course I care about what they think, and in marketing my writing and other stuff I care, but I don't care. Like I care like in the sense that I'm trying to deliver a message that's appealing. When it is coming from the heart, I hope that it is. I want to package it so that it's read, but I missed out on all of that peer pressure. I missed out on all of that, just this kind of nonsense. I mean, I missed out on things like chicken pox too, like I said, but I missed out on all this stuff. And I know that she'll probably deal with it, have to deal with it. But I might be able to help. I think that the way I experienced it might help her go through with it. Because I learned so early on that shit's just not important.
Sure.
We think that like the years like 14 to 10 to or whatever the childhood is such a big deal, and then young adulthood is such a big deal. Adolescence is such a big deal. Like for a while it seemed like every movie was about kids like trying to go to prom to get their cherry popped or something like that. Like that's like the height of life. But
Yeah.
for me, I knew that it never would be. Like I knew that there would be, this was life was a long game and that I was going to, I wanted to be doing my best work at 40, not my best work, which I'm coming up on, not my best work at 10 or 15 or 20. The guy, I remember starting to like my 10th high school reunion, people were talking about, oh, I can't do whatever like I used to. What does that even mean?
Yeah, that's crazy.
You're like fucking 28. Like,
Yeah.
come on. Like you should be in your prime, Like some people were like ready for retirement in that sense. Oh, my knee, my back. Or it just seemed like high school and that reunion hammered at home. I haven't been to any of the other ones, but that reunion hammered at home. That like high school was like fun for them or an experience in a way that it wasn't for me. So I didn't, don't miss it. I don't miss childhood. I don't miss college. I miss grad school because that was really when I began interacting with people. But I was finally like well read enough and like call, like acculturated enough that I could really appreciate the whole process of it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that might be a benefit to Cleo Rose. I've always counseled that to anybody that I've dealt with. I don't think homeschooling is, like, most people that are homeschooled for weirder, even weirder reasons than I was, but less, but not as cool, honestly. Yeah. Like lamer reasons, like, you know, we don't want the you know, the story of Genesis challenged. Like, who cares? Like, you don't fucking homeschool a kid over that. Like, yeah, I mean, if you're gonna homeschool a kid, let them like build their own curriculum out of comic books and Muscle Men magazines and so on. Don't make them like keep them under the bed next to a sweat sock or something like that. Like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah.
Like, I don't know. That's just that's my two cents on all that.
Yeah, I kind of sort of agree. I kind of lived a similar, I did not live a similar life. I lived a similar trajectory. I kind of consider everything that happened before college pretty much, or even mid college, to be a wash. It was like, it was okay. I enjoyed the time that I had. There were some highs, there were some lows, but I didn't really feel like I had the agency of a human being until I was 19 or 20. Like, after, once I started making decisions that really started affecting my life and forming relationships that really started affecting my life, that's when I started actually feeling like, oh, like, isn't this nice? Isn't this actually nice? Like, I am an autonomous human being that isn't beholden to, you know, some outside schedule. But I think that's interesting. I think that's really interesting. This entire thing has been interesting to me, Oliver. Honestly, I didn't know what to expect. I did not expect this. I'll tell you that. I didn't expect an hour and a half of the stories and the experiences. I did not expect that at all, and I really appreciate like the sort of honesty and the
it's nice to talk about that. I mean, when I do my show, it's more focused and like thematic episodes. Occasionally I do something like this. Occasionally I go on my friend Ralph Moffatone's show to do something like what we did here. I don't talk about, like, if I deal with this stuff, it's usually in essays and it's not sort of in a free floating way. So I appreciate coming on to talk about it.
Yeah. It was my pleasure to get a chance. And, you know, I think there's a lot of really interesting things to learn. Like, for me, selfishly, to give you an idea, the reason why I like doing this is because I'm a big, like, learn through conversation guy. Obviously I'm doing the thing of being a dad, so that's taking care of itself, the experiential portion of it, but speaking to somebody, speaking to many, many somebodies and getting that, their experience almost like a sponge, is a big part of how I learn. And I really enjoyed this conversation, dude.
Well, let me leave you with these words of wisdom then. Being a dad is real, and being a dad is fun, but being a dad is not real fun.
Nice. Very nice.
That's a variation on my high school yearbook quote, since we're talking about it's been real, it's been fun, but it hasn't been real fun.
That's like that's a professional writer there, ladies and gentlemen. Oliver Bateman, professional writer, professional,
right, doing creating. The work. Doing the work.
Some of the best work that has ever been done right there. Thank you, Oliver. I appreciate it, man.
Take care.